Hello and welcome to Journeys of Maxa podcast. I'm here today with Alexis Barton, who is Maxa's events director and also a piano instructor here. Welcome to our podcast today.
Oh, thank you.
So we're going to be talking a little bit about your journey in music and how you got interested in piano and musical studies. And I understand that it wasn't a completely linear path to where you are now. So I'm interested in talking about that and the choices you made along the way. Any barriers that you might have encountered? Of course, maybe you had zero barriers, you know?
No.
Okay, all right. I mean, you know, if you had zero, that's one option. And some of the things that you're active in now. So why don't we start with the past? How did you get started in music? And like what brought it into your life? And let's get started right there.
So like as a kid, of course, I was trying out all these different hobbies, trying to figure out like what my thing is going to be. And I was horrible at sports. Didn't like them, was bad at them. So my parents bought me a little Casio keyboard for Christmas one year when I was like 8. And they were like, well, do you want to take piano lessons? Because we have a friend who teaches piano. They're not musical at all. They just were trying to find something I liked and wasn't horrible at. And so I started taking piano lessons from a coworker of theirs. And once I start something, I tend to just kind of keep doing it until there's a reason I can't do it. So with sports, it was like, I would hurt myself or whatever. Okay. But in piano, like that didn't occur.
Didn't
so I just okay. kept going and I just never stopped.
Awesome. So actually that's pretty remarkable. Do you know what it was like? Had your parents, you said they had no musical training at all, but something must have made them think, hey, let's try this keyboard piano thing. Do you have any idea why they chose that as opposed to like, let's try the harp? Or let's try a double bass or something like that. Was there any?
Well, I think they had already talked to their coworker and she had told them piano was a good like starter instrument for music. My grandparents and like great grandparents were like musical.
Okay.
They actually had like a traveling band.
Oh, seriously?
And so I think they asked my grandma like, what should we start her with?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like to sing at all. I actually hated music class at school because they would make me sing.
Oh, okay.
And so that was not an option. So then piano became kind of the starter instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they had this vision that like, oh, our kids will take piano lessons for like a year and then they can maybe learn another instrument if they want to.
Which is true. I mean, actually is a great starter instrument. I'd love to hear some other time about this band that your grandparents had. That's kind of amazing.
I don't really know much about it because it was like my great grandparents.
Really?
So I never met them.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really know a lot about it. But my grandma has told me about this traveling like Barton band that
really?
They played in.
That sounds like a really fascinating something to explore some other time, but wow, amazing. So they got you started on this and you had this first coworker of theirs to teach you, and how long were you with that person?
I was with her for about 2 years and then she decided to take a step back from teaching and focus more on her other work. So I transferred to, well, I actually asked my orchestra director at school, hey, do you know any piano teachers? And her response was, I teach piano. And I was like,
awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you teach me?
Uh-huh.
And so then I studied with her for another few years before she took a step back from teaching.
Mm-hmm.
She like moved to Florida.
Okay.
And then I, in high school, transferred to my high school teacher who really helped develop me as a pianist.
Okay.
In those years.
But. And at what time, like when did you also transition to instruments? Because one of the good things about keyboards, of course, some of them are absolutely amazing and do all sorts of wonderful things, but sometimes they can be a little limiting, but also a good choice if you're just getting started and not sure if you're gonna stick with it. At what point y'all upgraded, or was it a really phenomenal Casio? I mean,
no, it was not a phenomenal Casio.
Okay.
It was like
the
really basic Casio that like,
that's kind of what, when you said
still
that,
on the
like,
market,
that's what I had in my head, was that
the keys light up.
That's the one. That's the exact one. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Right,
the keys
light
up. It has like the little song bank.
Totally.
It'll play songs for you.
Totally. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I can't remember exactly when we got my Yamaha Digital, but my parents like noticed that I was getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if my teacher suggested it or not. I was very oblivious, but I saw this Yamaha Digital at Costco. at one point and was like playing on it in the store. And I was like, oh, this feels so good. Like it feels like a real piano. Yes, and so I begged my parents to buy it for me for my birthday. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what holiday they bought it for, but I think it was a birthday.
Okay.
They ended up making the purchase.
That's great. You know, that's because part of what's interesting about that story is that I do think there's a relationship between like the responsiveness of the instrument that you have and that leveling up of interest in performing, right, and practicing, right, because you're getting a kind of a different feedback loop from the instrument itself. And the fact that you actually played it, right, you played it, you felt it, you heard it, and were like, wow, this is the next step for me. And then, of course, kids tend to be very good at, you know, convincing their parents to buy things, which obviously you did. So, do you remember how that affected like your practicing at the time after you actually got it home?
I mean, I remember wanting to practice like all the time, but that was, I mean, I practiced a lot even on the Casio.
Okay.
And when I would go to my grandma's house, because my parents would travel a lot and we would stay at our grandma's, she had an organ. I would even practice on the organ. The pedals didn't work at all, the foot pedals. But I would like play my left hand on the bottom and my right hand on the top.
Oh, wow.
Of the two
actually,
like,
that's
manuals.
Pretty complicated.
And I just practiced on whatever I could get my hands on. But I really liked this Yamaha. I had heard, like, for some reason I had in my head that Yamaha was like the ultimate brand of musical instrument. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted this Yamaha keyboard. And I know when we got it, I did practice a lot on it. And then when I was about 13, I decided I wanted a baby grand.
Okay.
And I didn't realize, you know, as a child, you don't realize how expensive those are.
Of course not. No.
I was just like, I want a piano for Christmas.
Right.
And my parents were like, we're not buying you a piano. But my mom actually convinced my dad, like, she needs a piano. Because he heard me playing a Bergmuller arabesque one day upstairs on my Yamaha, digital.
Yeah.
And they heard me up there practicing. And they thought it was the recorded,
seriously,
like, the piano playing itself.
Wow.
And then they walked up and realized it was me. And my mom at that point went, okay, we have to buy her a piano.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate that my parents could like make that happen, and they found a great deal on a Yamaha Baby Grand from the technician that they contacted. Mm-hmm. So it was that made that possible for my family to afford. But once we got the Baby Grand, like I couldn't stop playing it. Like I was just playing it all the time.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, I think people. It makes sense to be cautious as a parent. Like I'm going through that now as a parent, like, you know, when to upgrade something. But when you know that your child is responding, it makes a massive difference to have an upgrade if you can figure it out. And usually there are creative ways to make that happen. So I'm glad to hear that was the path in your case, and both of those instruments are super high quality. And they're unless you do something damaging to them, right? Like throw them outside or something like that. They'll last forever. So, so you started practicing a lot more then. And now you also mentioned that you had a orchestra director. And I'm assuming were you probably weren't playing that Casio in the orchestra?
No.
What were you doing in the orchestra?
So I started playing violin in orchestra in fifth grade.
Okay.
I really kind of wanted to play the cello, but I walked to school and I was very tiny, and I was like,
right, practical.
I don't want to carry a cello around.
Totally.
And I thought, like, everyone would laugh at me if I said I wanted to play the cello because I was so small.
Okay.
So I chose the violin because I knew I wanted to play a string instrument. Mm. And violin is obviously the smallest of the family.
Good point.
So I started on a little half-size violin started orchestra in fifth grade. I didn't take private lessons on the violin till I was a freshman in high school.
Okay.
But just being in the like community ensemble was a really cool like difference from practicing piano like by myself. It made music like a social thing for me because I had friends in orchestra class. And that was a really, I thought that was a really cool experience to get to have like both sides of things.
Right.
I had the instrument I was really passionate about, and then I had the, you know, community aspect that was fun.
Right, and I think that's continued even now. I mean, I know we're jumping ahead in the story here a little bit, but even now, my understanding, you're in an orchestra in San Antonio, you're still, you know, making that social aspect of music making, of performing, a part of your life.
Yeah, I play in the San Antonio Community Orchestra, which has people from, you know, all different professions and things, and I really enjoy getting to do something like social with music, and then I can still practice my piano mostly alone. I do play for a church, so I interact with people in that regard too. Right. But yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's go back to like, okay, so then you, so now you're in high school. You've had this teacher that really, you said, helped you. I think you said turned you into a pianist in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like really helped you as pianistically. I'd be happy to hear more about that. Or also, well, I definitely also want to get into your choice of college and like what were your majors and stuff like that, and how you ended up choosing what you ended up ultimately choosing.
Yeah. So in high school, I had a really wonderful teacher. He at our first lesson, he gave me like the first movement of like a Haydn sonata, and I had never seen anything so like difficult before. So I was like very scared of it, but I didn't want to disappoint my new teacher. So I went home and I practiced a lot, and I learned the first movement, most of it within the first like week.
You did?
I was practicing like 2 hours. I was so scared that I was going to disappoint him at our second lesson, because I didn't know him well enough yet to know that like he was chill. So I went back to my, you know, second lesson and played it for him, and we worked on it. But a lot of my like practice at that time was motivated by just like, he seems like he was a doctoral student at the local university, and he was, I didn't want to like let him down. He didn't know me yet, you know, because my previous teacher had been my orchestra director. So she knew me very well. And we had this like personal relationship
prior to the lessons, right?
Like, So there was a little bit less pressure with her. But with him, I felt like, well, I don't know him, so I want to make sure that like I make a good first impression, and he knows I'm going to be a hardworking student. And I just kind of kept that momentum going, that like desire to make my teacher happy kept me practicing. I mean, I enjoyed it, of course, as well, and he just progressively assigned me harder and harder repertoire. Some of what he assigned me, I would probably never give to a student now, because I'm like, wow, like that was hard. And he was just like, here, learn to play, you know, Wiedemung or whatever. And I was just but because he challenged me so much, it really worked. I was playing repertoire that was really exciting and fun. And he decided that I told him I wanted to be a music minor going to college. And so he was like, well, you're just going to do the major audition. And I was like, but why? And he was like, just do the major audition. I was like, okay, sure. So I did audition to be a music major. Like I did the audition requirements. He thought the audition requirements for the minor were too easy, so I did the performance major requirements, auditioned, was accepted as a music minor because I had done the performance major requirements. I started college at Arizona State University, where he had been a doctoral student. But when I started college, I kind of, I was a biochemistry major. And a music minor. And music kind of fell to the side for a minute because I was focusing on my biochemistry stuff.
Yeah, that's like really hard stuff. I mean, you know this because you've lived it. I've only heard like that is a very challenging major to do.
I mean, the coursework wasn't terrible the first year because I had taken a lot of AP classes in high school, and so I was basically reviewing things that I already knew and developing a deeper understanding of them, but not learning them for the first time. But all I wanted to do was practice, and I didn't have time because I was in lab all the time. And so I felt very conflicted my first year because I just wanted to play the piano, and I didn't have time to play the piano because I was too busy doing chemistry stuff. And so actually after my first year of college, I went to my parents and told them, I want to change my major to music ed. And they said, no, you started a chemistry degree. You're going to finish your chemistry degree. And I was like, okay. And I even considered dropping out of university, going to community college for music. Because I didn't know that I could just transfer into the program, but I ended up sticking it out for another year at Arizona State, continue my biochemistry studies, And then I just couldn't take it anymore. Yeah, I was like, no, I don't want to do this.
Right.
Part of the problem at Arizona State was that I was taking lessons with first year TAs.
I wasn't,
as a music minor, I didn't get lessons with a professor. So I had kind of, I felt like downgraded in my teacher
because
he was a second year doctoral student, third year doctoral student. He was there for a while. But then I was taking lessons with first year master's students. And my first teacher was giving me pieces that were so easy. And I was so like annoyed because I was like, I can play way harder repertoire than this. And it was beautiful repertoire, but it just, it wasn't the virtuosic stuff I was used to playing. And so, I wasn't happy with my like musical life at Arizona State. And so that ultimately motivated me, even though I was told I needed to continue in chemistry. I was like, well, I'm transferring universities.
Gotcha.
So I auditioned at Northern Arizona University because I already knew the piano professor there from attending music camp in high school.
That's such a great way to get to know professors.
Absolutely. He would always do the auditions at music camp. So he had heard me play before. And even though I wasn't like, I didn't give the best audition, he knew from seeing me each summer that like I was a decent pianist and that I was very committed to practicing.
Hardworking.
Because one of the things that they had told me at camp was that like I improved the most every year. Even though I wasn't the best pianist there. So he knew that I was like committed. And so even as a music minor, I still kept my minor at this point. He was willing to take me as his student.
Oh, that's great.
So I transferred there my junior year and I was on a accompanying scholarship, which was really fun. It was the first time I got to do any collaborative piano.
And I bet you did a lot then if you were on a scholarship, you probably like.
It wasn't like a ton. It was, I think the requirement was like four.
Other performers.
Yeah, four other performers. So I usually had like a couple vocalists and then a couple instrumentalists
so was it like
each
a
semester.
Dump of 60 people on your
No, not at all. But I found that I really like accompanying saxophone, which most people hate because it's
very hard.
But I found it really satisfying because I got to play the hard stuff. And I found that I really liked accompanying violin because I knew a lot of the repertoire already. And so that was a really cool experience. And I felt like they didn't treat me there any differently as a music minor than the music majors. They had the same expectations of me. They, you know, gave me the same opportunities. And so I really thrived in the School of Music there. But again, I just wanted to practice all the time and not be in labs. I was still doing my chemistry degree. And so I was determined to just finish. But I got to my senior year and thought, oh my gosh, I'm about to graduate. What kind of job am I going to work with this chemistry degree? I'm going to be in a lab. I hated labs.
Good point.
I was like, I'm going to be in a lab like every day. And like, there's no windows in there sometimes. And like, it's very dark. And I was also horrible at labs. I was great at like the theoretical aspects of chemistry. Like I could do all the calculations and everything perfectly fine. But when it came to actually like dumping things in the centrifuge and like test tubes and all that. I mean, like I would turn things into like smoking black liquid that weren't supposed to be that.
Awesome, actually, that part of it. But I'm sure they frowned upon by the professors.
I did not have a talent for lab work, and that's what chemistry in the real world was going to look like. So I started devising this plan. And I only told my grandmother about my plan because I knew she would be supportive and I knew my parents would not be, at first. And so I decided I was going to add a second major in music, switch my minor to a second major. And unfortunately, like the way the curriculum was set up, like that was going to make, graduating on time, like impossible.
Usually you're, it's like an extra year, I think, typically, or, you tell the story, obviously.
So for me, it was an extra year. And I was fine with that, but, I was on, you know, scholarship. So I needed to make sure that my scholarship would carry me through that extra year. So the piano faculty, when I told them I wanted to do this, were very supportive. They were like, yes, you want to be a piano major, you're in, like, that's fine. But the director of the School of Music actually pulled me aside at one point and was like, you can't circumvent curriculum. And I was like, well, I got all the signatures I needed to like take some of these prerequisites at the same time. Like I needed to take my junior writing course.
Right, yes, and of course. I see what you're talking about.
Theory 4 was a prerequisite.
Yes.
And I wanted to take it at the same time I was taking Theory 4, right? Because I hadn't taken that as part of my minor. And the director of the School of Music called me in and was like, you can't circumvent curriculum like this. Like, and I said, well, I got all the signatures to do it from the professors, though. And he was like, it's just, this isn't right. And I was like, I'm sorry, but I'm going to do it. Like, they already signed off on it. Right, I turned in the paperwork. Right. Like, and the day before I was supposed to graduate, I was when I finally had all my signatures done. And I went to the advising office and said, I would like to add a second major in music. And the advisor looked at me and went, you graduate tomorrow. And I was like, no, I don't want to graduate tomorrow. Because it's so much harder if you graduate to like start a second degree.
Oh, actually, you're right. That's totally right. Yeah.
So I was like, no, I want the double major added now. And he said, well, you need to audition. And I was like, just call my professors. I don't need to audition. They've already approved this. And like, just put it in the system so that I have a second major in music. And my second major was a Bachelor of Arts, not performance, because that goes better with like the double major.
Right, that makes sense.
So yeah, he finally put it in and I walked out of there and I called my parents and said, I'm a music major now. I'm not graduating. I mean, I'd already kind of told them, don't drive up for graduation.
Right, okay, good. That's nice. That's good.
But like, I was really excited. I mean, I walked out of there feeling like more happy than like I ever had, because I was finally going to be doing music. And that last year of school, it took me one extra year to finish that second bachelor's degree. But since I was done with my chemistry requirements, I was only taking music classes. And it was like just amazing. Like, I finally felt like I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And I just really enjoyed getting to focus solely on music. Like, and no one was surprised because I had been so involved for so long anyways. Like, when I told...
Right, they were probably like, oh, wait, I thought you were a music major already.
Yeah, so, like it just, like, my routine just kind of stayed the same. I just dropped all the chemistry stuff because I was done with it. And it was probably, like, the happiest year of my life getting to, like, be in, just because it was, like, so new to me to finally be doing music all the time.
That's awesome. You know, there's so many great lessons in what you're talking about here, because you did try. It's important to try different things out. Obviously, you had an affinity for part of chemistry, right? And you tried it. You tried it hard. You really put you went for it, right? I mean, it wasn't just like a weekend you tried chemistry or went to chemistry camp. I mean, you had 3 solid years, right? 3 or 4 years of chemistry, right?
Four years.
Okay. And then went through that journey enough to find that, okay, I don't want to live that life, right? Like, you look forward into the life that was going to be. And at the same time, it's not like when you were practicing piano, you were saying, oh, I really wish I was in a lab. I wish I was doing chemistry instead of practicing. It was the opposite, right? You were missing music. So you recognize that in yourself. And then the thing that I think is particularly clever, and I know this to be a factor in my existence also, usually, especially in the arts world, if you go to the professors first and they recognize you as a kindred spirit, a kindred musical artistic spirit, they will move mountains to get all the other stuff to work. Had you asked the head of the school first or any of the people on the admin side if you could do it, they would have told you absolutely not. And you know what I mean? Like, you went the right pathway in a sense to go through that, and then of course you stuck with it. Now, am I capturing that correctly?
Yeah,
pretty much. So what was it that made you you mentioned you talked to your grandmother about it. Was your grandmother kind of a sounds like she was sort of a musical resource, or I you know what I think it is I think she seems to have your best, not that your parents also don't have your best interest in mind, but kind of from a more like such a big overview of you as a person and your whole life, you know, because I'm trying to imagine what would it be like for me if my son suddenly changed, you know. I think any parent would be like, oh no, you know, we had this path that we thought was going to work. We had a certain vision of where it was going to go. But your grandmother, again, is looking from a little bit of a different perspective. So what do you think it was that kind of led you to kind of go that way, like to reach out to the one to decide I'm going to do this, two to go to the professors first?
Well, I had to tell somebody.
Well, that's true.
So
okay, good point.
I was like, I told my grandma first because like I knew she couldn't stop me. You know, my parents could have driven up there and been like, you are not doing this.
Okay, I got you. Okay, that makes sense.
And but my grandma was always very like supportive. Mm-hmm. So like, and not that my parents weren't, they were very supportive of my musical activities too. They came to all my concerts and everything. But I knew that like she would be more understanding of like the switch. Mm-hmm. And my parents would be more hesitant just because they didn't believe that you could make money in music.
I see.
And they wanted me to be financially stable as an adult.
Right.
So I told her first. Mm-hmm. And then as far as my professors, like I went there just because I knew them the best and I knew that they knew me the best.
Right.
The head of the department, I mean, I knew him quite well, too. It was a small department.
Okay.
So, but I knew that my professors had been, like, encouraging me to kind of do this. Like, they'd been sneaking in
They sort of planted some seeds.
Yeah. Okay, they were like, you know, you really could, like, do this instead.
Okay,
some talent for this and things like that. So, like, I knew that they would support me. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know for sure. The head of the department, when I had toured the school as a senior in high school, I had said, I might want a double major. And he's like, no, people don't do that here.
Oh, okay.
So
I
already kind of knew that he was not going to be on board.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, that's awesome. I'm gonna shift a little bit for a sec here. And well, one thing before we shift, though, I want to make sure I get the name of this, your high school teacher who was so influential to you. Could we have his name?
Dr. Ching-Ching Yi.
Oh, fantastic. And then who was it you studied with I'm blanking out, Northern Arizona State,
yeah,
I think it was?
Northern Arizona University.
Okay, university. And who was it that you studied with there?
Dr. Frank Scott.
Okay, fantastic. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this. We're going to completely shift gears, but it does kind of go into the journey a little bit because you also experienced some other barriers. And I heard you talk about this in this really phenomenal professional development session you did on these pianos that we're borrowing from SMU and the DS Standard Foundation. I really got so much out of that, out of your approach, because you looked at all the survey data and whatnot on issues with people with hands that are smaller than what the current piano size is kind of built for. This is a huge topic, of course. But can you speak a little bit about what your experience was? In that talk, you talked about the violin. That's one of the reasons I wanted to make sure we spoke about violin. And then your experience with the piano and with normal size keys and kind of your journey with sort of confronting the fact that most pianos have the same size keys, which seem to be not made for all.
Yeah. So I didn't really notice until I was like in high school that like my hands were small because I was playing repertoire for, you know, children that was made for, you know, you're usually in like five finger patterns or maybe you play a sixth or an octave here or there, nothing crazy. And then when I started getting into really advanced repertoire, I was getting frustrated because I was like, I can't reach this.
Yeah.
My teacher was very understanding and accommodating in that like we would alter the score
That's
in some way
to
make things playable for me. So for example, I played like Gershwin's Third Prelude when I auditioned for colleges, and the last section is all in octaves
it's
in the
crazy.
Right hand.
Yeah.
And we revoiced the chord, so I was playing sixth most of the time.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
As long as like they fit within the chordal structure.
Right.
But so I could, you know, hit the tempo and keep the excitement up without like, because playing the octaves just wasn't an option.
Right. Absolutely.
So, yeah, and I noticed, you know, playing the violin was just easier because I was playing, I started on a half-size violin. Mm-hmm. I moved up to a three-quarter, and then I bought a full-size violin sometime in high school. And then my teacher told me sophomore year, you know, you're not growing anymore. You never grew into this instrument, like, because we bought it thinking I would grow into it, and then I just didn't grow.
Mm-hmm.
So she told my parents she really needs a three-quarter. So we went and bought a three-quarter violin, like a better quality one than the student one I had been using.
Right.
It was so much easier to practice the violin because I could reach everything I wanted to.
Right.
And practicing on the piano was like, I had to rework things and rewrite things and make it playable for my hands. Mm-hmm. I talked a little bit in my presentation, but so the average octave size for a standard piano is 6.5 inches, and my reach from 1 to 5 is only 6.7 inches.
Oh, wow.
So I am like, I can barely reach an octave, but certainly not enough to like play it with ease, play
or
them
play
quickly.
Chords,
yeah, play yeah, chords, chords, play fast octave passages. Like it's just not possible. So I didn't really know that there was any solution for me other than altering the music until I got to my master's program, actually, and started doing research on like small hand adaptations for the piano. And that's when I kind of discovered that like, hey, they do make smaller keyboards. They're very rare. And I didn't think I would ever be lucky enough to like actually encounter one. But it was really exciting to me to hear that that was like something that existed.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's actually a lot of people, part of what you pointed out in your presentation is that it's exceedingly common that there are multiple sizes of string instruments. And that's been going on for a really, really long time. Whereas with the keyboard, once it got, I think, established, what, in the late 1800s or something like that, they just stuck with it. And it's, you know, and there are reasons, but in a way, you could say, well, they have the same manufacturing challenges with violins too, right? Like the fact that they can make so many different kinds and not on the keyboard is, I don't know, it's a little hard to buy that there isn't some other solution than just making them all the same.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, I mean, people are different, right? People are different sizes. One of the things you talked about in your presentation that I liked so much was used basketball as an example. And you had like, because the basketball hoop was 10 feet off the ground or something like that.
Something
like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they tends to lean towards very tall people, right? Playing basketball. And it made me think when you were, I think this was after your talk, I was like, wait, what if the basketball, what if it was shorter, would we have more intense basketball games? Like if it was 9 or 8 feet, probably more people would be playing basketball. And the basketball games, you'd sort of attract even more talented people to the court in a way. Like that barrier of height only would be kind of mitigated a little bit, you know? Now it's dangerous to say I'm not an avid basketball fan. I have to be careful here. But what I'm getting at is that I'm open-minded about basketball in ways that I might not have originally been about piano, but it seems to be like more talented people or more people, not even talented, but more people who could enjoy playing basketball is not a bad thing. It seems like there'd be more people who would get involved watching the sport. Again, not that they're hurting for fans, but on the piano, you know, getting more people able to play is a good thing, I think. You know, that's a good thing. And even the fact that, you know, when I've taught kids that will sometimes be quite accelerated and they're struggling with overcoming the size of the piano keyboards, a lot of times they'll use physical tension, or I'll get transfer students that have used physical tension to play advanced repertoire. And it takes sometimes years to train them out of that. You know, years of to get them rid of that tension. The association of a big chord with tension is so deeply ingrained. It really takes somebody who's very determined. And it seems like if they had like some sort of way to graduate through sizes, that it would again create more opportunities for free playing and whatnot. So, but they are hard to find. They are hard to find. So we're really grateful because Carol Leone and the folks at the DS Standard Foundation loaned us these pianos for a year, and it's been great to have an experience with them. So what we really should do is we should go over there, and you can show our audience what these pianos are like, and maybe we could talk a little bit about what it's like for you to play on the different instruments and adapt to them, and just kind of what it feels like to practice for you on these smaller instruments. So why don't we go ahead and we'll head over to the recital hall. Well, welcome to the Maxa Recital Hall. We're here with Alexis Barton, and we're going to be exploring these different size piano keyboards that we have here in the Recital Hall. So we have a standard size piano, a universal size, and a 7/8 size keyboard. And I thought maybe the first thing we should compare is just our hand sizes. So I have what I would consider a what typically works on a regular piano-sized hand, if that makes any sense. I'm not sure how to say that specifically. So this is like my hand size, and there's your hand size. And now I think we also need to maybe, let's do it on the keyboard as well. We have a keyboard, and by the way, this one, this view has like kind of a fisheye bend. None of these pianos are curved, okay? These are regular non-curved pianos. So, okay, go ahead and like just put your hand down. Okay, so then there's mine. Okay, and what, if you play like an octave, let's see what that looks like. Which you do very well. Beautifully, a gorgeous octave, lovely tone. Really enjoyed it. If I do an octave, it's like this. And what is like your maximum reach?
I mean, I can reach the octave and play them occasionally, but I can't play like strings of octaves. So my maximum for anything virtuosic is a seven.
Right, right. And you can, I can tell that in order to do that, like, so when I'm doing like a 10 or like an 11, I can barely get 11. But when I do a 10, it looks a little bit like what your octave looks like, right? So I can do a 10th, I can get a chord into a 10th sometimes, but it's not like I'm dreaming of doing a whole bunch of 10ths in a row kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I can only get chords depending on the voicing. So for example, like a root position chord is fine.
Okay.
If I try to play, this is fine.
Right.
But if I try to play like an A minor chord here,
yikes.
It's much harder.
Oh. That does not look fun. Okay, and I'm imagining like that kind of stuff is probably not happy. Very good. So obviously, I mean, clearly you've learned how to work with these instruments, but it's, I can definitely tell that like the kind of hoops you're having to jump through to get it to work for you is way more than, it's like you have a lot of extra barriers in a sense, right, to kind of deal with. And then how does your body feel when you do that, like your arm and stuff, your shoulders?
I'm just a little bit uncomfortable. Like everything just feels very stretched.
Yeah.
So my hand is stretching.
Right.
And then my, you know, arm can only be positioned one way to make that possible. And I'm not really able to use like a lot of shoulder motion, because if I try to use just arm weight to drop onto an octave,
right,
I'm not going to catch it. I have to stretch to
wow.
it and squeeze
Got it.
To get
wow.
it.
So that actually is a change of your entire playing mechanism then, really. You know, it's kind of like I tell people sometimes they don't realize how much what you do with the keyboard matters until you imagine something like, imagine you were trying to run a race, but your toes were like really curled or something like that, right? It would feel weird. Like you could still get somewhere, but it would feel unusual, right?
Yeah.
It would lock you down. Anything else you want to say about this creature before we try one of the other ones?
No.
Okay, so this is like the one that you typically are going to find on any piano that you buy, and then we're going to look at the universal size now. So let's go over to that one. So here we are at the universal size keyboard. Now this one is a 6-inch octave. The one we were on before, the more common piano size is a 6.5-inch octave. So we're going to take a look at this one over here. This one's, like I said, called the universal. Again, once you see the view overview, this is not a curved piano, it's completely straight. So let's look at this octave. All right, beautifully played. Looks a lot more comfortable. And what would you say your largest stretch is on this one?
I can barely hit a ninth.
You can hit a ninth.
Okay. My ninths here feel like my octaves over
there. So it's a pretty significant difference there. So for me, I can easily hit that 11th that I was trying to hit over there before. So easily at 11th. 10th feels really good. So to me, this particular instrument, I played one of these a long time ago at a conference, and I found this very easy to adapt to. Like literally within maybe a minute, I could play pretty much anything that I had played on a normal piano size. That I found that to be quite interesting. So let's go ahead and take a look at then the other one. What's the octave size on the 7/8 one?
5.5 inches.
5.5, that's very significant. Okay, we're going to take a look at that one next. So now we're sitting at the smallest of the keyboards. This is a 5.5-inch octave. You can see it's quite different. Again, on the overhead, it's not curved. It's a completely straight keyboard. So let's take a look at this one now. So let's have a, why don't you do the same octave again? Wow. Okay, the way you play that octave, I have to say, looks way more natural than before. Why don't you do a chord for us? Wow. Yeah, it's almost like the language of your body changes. How does your shoulder feel?
My shoulder feels like it's able to like engage more. I can drop with more arm weight because I'm not worried about squeezing into the cord.
To me, actually, your tone, it has that kind of arm weight sound to it, like behind it, that engagement there. And that's one of the things that I kind of, in a way, I should have expected that, but it's pleasant to see. So I'm going to try also. So here's my octave. And let's see, I guess I can easily get a little louder there. Way more than the normal. But for me, this seems very, very small. Very small. Same to me. Yeah. But it's obviously a totally different experience for you. So what does this feel like? Like of the three, which one do you personally enjoy the most?
This is by far the most comfortable of the three for me.
Yeah.
Even on that one, my octaves, if I try to play them quickly, I'll still miss them.
The
yeah, even okay. on the yeah. 6-inch uh-huh. one, I'll still miss them.
Okay.
But on this 5.5, I can play octaves
that is,
like it's no big deal.
That's crazy.
So this feels the most natural to me.
Yeah.
And I can just relax my hands and let them play instead of thinking stretch all the time.
That's got to be a completely different musical experience to then not have to be, like I imagine the amount of calculations you have to be doing playing a normal size keyboard. It's probably hard to engage sometimes musically.
I think my musicality on this is a lot better because I'm not stressing about if I'm going to hit that note.
Yeah.
Or especially working on voicing, I don't necessarily have to think about, well, this is as loud as I can play this note because I'm barely reaching it.
Right.
I can really voice melodies on this a lot better because I have more control over the weight in my hands. Mm-hmm. And I just feel more free when I play this. So I'm more engaged and like more in a state of flow playing on this instrument than on a standard instrument. And I feel like my musicality improves because of that.
Yeah, no doubt. And now these are made by the Heilung Company. They do the uprights. They also have a version for grands where you can get a specifically designed, I think, for a grand piano. And I think you can either contact Heilung Company directly or work with the DS Standard Foundation to learn more about these instruments. But what anything else you want to share about the instruments or your journey with these different size keyboards?
Just that playing on them really is, I finally feel normal as a pianist when I'm able to play these instruments. I don't feel limited anymore by my hand size, and that's really beautiful because I think it just makes more music accessible to me. And I'm sure other people with smaller hands can relate that playing things like Rachmaninoff or Liszt are, you know, things that we don't want to tackle sometimes because we feel like we can't do it. But with access to these instruments, I feel like I can be the pianist that I want to be.
Yeah. Wow. Beautifully said. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us today. Alexis, it's been so much fun to talk to you and to learn more about these instruments and how your journey has been had some barriers, but you've overcome them in creative ways. And I think with learning more about these instruments, you have even more barriers that are going to be falling down in front of you so you can continue on your musical journey. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Bye-bye.